Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of September. Dante Chinney is our guest this hour. His book is out, Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. Dante has traveled all over the country and has been doing this for a couple of years now, looking at pockets that are similar, counties that may be similar, even though you would think that they would be very, very different because they're counties that may be in a blue state or a red state on the East Coast or the West Coast, and yet those counties share more in common than they would with people in their blue state or red state. He has traveled to all of these places and written about them extensively in this new book. There are 3,141 counties in this country. No two are alike, but some share a median age or a household income or education level. Some are urban, some are rural, sparsely populated. On a map, two counties may be hundreds or thousands of miles away from each other, but in terms of their shared experiences, they're like neighbors. So he breaks these down and then describes them in a very interesting book. Boom towns, evangelical epicenters, military bastions, service workers, campus and careers, immigration nation, minority central, tractor country, Mormon outposts, emptying nests, industrial metropolises, and moneyed burbs. And then looks at those counties that are up for grabs when it comes to election. It looks at what's happening with jobs and how the recession has affected people in all of those counties. Dante is a longtime journalist since the run-up to the 2008 presidential election. He's been the correspondent for the award-winning Patchwork Nation Project, which is a collaboration among the Christian Science Monitor, PBS NewsHour, and PBS member stations funded by the Knight Foundation. He has covered politics and the media for a number of years. His work has appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, in Newsweek, The New Republic, and The Washington Post Magazine, and other publications. And he is our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Hello again, Dante. Nice to have you on the air.
Well, hey, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not bad.
Well, good. So you hate that red map, blue map, Dante.
Yeah. This idea really started from looking at the red map, blue map, and just realizing kind of how silly it is. I mean, it's especially silly when you get to the state level because, you know, Texas may be a very red state, but anybody from Austin will tell you that it is not a red, not a red city. And you know, ditto is true actually, even in the bluest states. When you get, I mean, New York may be a very blue state. If you get up to the outer reaches of upstate New York, it can be quite you know, red. But the bigger point is that, you know, the blue and red just doesn't tell you very much. I mean, ultimately, the idea of a blue and a red map, it's not that it's useless. It does. It's a way of keeping score, and that's what we do, especially on election nights, especially presidential election nights. But, you know, it doesn't tell you why people voted the way they did.
Right.
And it, the blue-red, you know, dichotomy that we've built into our heads somehow suggests that, well, everybody votes Republican for the same reason, and everybody votes Democratic for the same reason. And what we wanted to do was try to get past all that stuff. I mean, we really wanted to break down different kinds, not demographic groups, but different kinds of community in the country. And we started off thinking, you know, just why do they vote the way they do? That's how this whole thing started anyway.
And then you had to look at the whole country, and then you come up with all these counties. You talk about you just have to know how to look for them to find out the different Americas within the borders of the United States. How do you know how to look for them?
That's a good question. I mean, when it comes to breaking down the counties, the 3,141 counties, which we did, it's just a lot of data, and then the statistician that I work with on this book, his name is Professor Jim Gimple, he's at the University of Maryland. He, you know, I went to him with this idea in 2007 and told him what I wanted to do, and he said, you know, there are systematic ways to do analysis that would give us what we wanted, and we could do it at the county level. And then once you get those things, you essentially assign scores for all these different demographic characteristics. And we're talking, you know, we did a lot here.
You did. It's huge.
It's mm-hmm. not just, you know, race or ethnicity or income or, you know, or general consumer kind of consumer traits and kind of consumer data. It's all these things mashed together, you know, scores of data points. And then you give every county in America a certain score, and they're like, this county falls, you know, this county scores 100 for being a moneyed burb, and it scores like maybe only 20 for being, you know, or maybe it scores 0 for being a military bastion, or maybe it scores like 5 for being what we'd call an emptying nest, and then that becomes a moneyed burb. So once you map all these things, then you say, okay, that's what everything looks like from 30,000 feet, but what happens when you go into a place? So, you know, we had every county in America scored, and we said, well, what are the best representations for these places?
And then you went to all those places.
Yeah, and I've gone to them repeatedly, and I've been going to them for 2.5 years, and going to these places, and, you know, you get to know these people, and you really get to know the communities. I know these communities very well now, and they're just really, really fascinating. I mean, I've learned more about the United States in the last 2.5 years than I have in the 20 years before then, because you really get a sense when you get out there of how big and complicated the country is. And as soon as you go to all these different places and you talk to people, I mean, people sense this, I think, if you do a big car trip across the country and you stop in places, you know, you sense that, you know, there's just, it's a big country with a lot of diversity. But even with all that diversity, as complicated as the country is, you can't just look at it all. I mean, it is tempting to look at it all sometimes and say, like, ugh, well, every place is unique. I can't say anything about it. You know, but that's not really true. Mm-hmm. There are similarities, and that's what we get at in the book. And we're not saying that all these, that like every service worker center is the same, or every boom town, as we categorize one, is the same. But, you know, it's what we are saying is that there are enough similarities between these type of places that when you look at them all together, you can say something about them, and that's what we're trying to do.
Right. Let's start with, because you're a Michigan guy, Ann Arbor, Michigan. The
right.
President's going to be in Madison this afternoon, this campus in careers. And you start this with this really interesting story about the newspaper, the publicized newspaper, not giving us the daily newspaper anymore, but Ann Arbor greets it with it's all right. We go online.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was there when this happened. I mean, I was going to Ann Arbor, and, you know, I grew up about an hour from Ann Arbor and outside Detroit. And, you know, I was there when it was announced that Ann Arbor was no longer going to have a newspaper, that Ann Arbor was, you know, going to lose its newspaper. And I thought that people would be up in arms about this. Ann Arbor is a very literate community. It's a lot, you know, Ann Arbor, which is Washtenaw County, is a lot like Madison, you know, Dane County. These are literate people. But the reaction was, well, you know, it's sad to lose the paper, but, you know, we all read the New York Times anyway, and we're all online, and it's not a big deal for us. And that you see more of that reaction in those kinds of communities because, you know, those campus and careers communities like Washtenaw County, like Dane County, those places are wired, and the college students in particular, you know, a BlackBerry is not an uncommon thing on a college campus.
Oh,
it's a
my.
Very common thing now, and this is what they use to read the news. I teach a class now. I teach at American University here in Washington, and it is, you know, it is a completely different world, and these are the places kind of at the vanguard of the American technological revolution where media is concerned.
There's also, I'm wondering if we're seeing the beginning of the new economy in places like this. You talk about the love of green, about the stimulus money that has come to some of these campus and career areas, counties.
Yeah, in fact, you know, we saw it a lot in Ann Arbor, and you must be seeing it there too, outside Madison or in Madison, where, you know, we spend some time in this book talking about the economy. We spend, you know, the beginning of the book, we have 12 short chapters about these 12 communities and how they represent their types, but then we have three big sections in the back of the book and say, okay, we've identified these places. What does it mean for the economy? What does it mean for politics? And what does it mean for culture? You know, and what we see economically for communities like Madison and Ann Arbor is these places are actually situated pretty well. I mean, they have the things that you need as for a community as everything moves forward. They are well educated, and they're going to get money. And I actually think the stimulus money is just part of it. I mean, the one thing I think Republicans and Democrats, you know, will agree on, even as everybody's talking about cutting, is, you know, they will want money for research and development. Most people will say, hey, we need, you know, the world's changing. We need research and development money. You know, where's that money going to go?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to go to places like Ann Arbor and Madison. They are well positioned. Now, it's not like they're immune from cuts or they're going to just sail through everything completely easily, but they're going to have a lot easier time than other places in the country.
Right. Yeah. And we're talking to you. We're part of a statewide network, so our headquarters are in Madison, but
right.
I'm in Milwaukee, which is a whole different, you look at the difference between the two places. Milwaukee would be in the industrial metropolises, I would think.
It is.
And struggling in many ways, but a whole different county.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, you know, and you guys, you have some space between, you know, Dane County and Milwaukee County. The interesting thing in Michigan is that Washtenaw County runs right up against Wayne County, which is Detroit's home county. And those pictures are night and day, those two places. And, I mean, they share a border. The counties share a border. And they're Wayne County will get some of what Washtenaw County gets. But, you know, they're just the future of those two places look very different. And in Milwaukee County, I mean, I am not as familiar with what's going on in Milwaukee. It's not one of the places I go, but I mean, I assume you're having some of the problems. I mean, there are some of the problems that big cities have there.
Right, sure. There's so much in this book, but this is astounding because you would think this wouldn't be the case, that it runs counter to what most of us would believe. The number of truly American cultural experiences you write in the culture section of the book is shrinking.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when we talk about, you know, American, you know, as one country kind of cultural experience, there are fewer things that kind of bind us. We live in an era, particularly where media is concerned, of niching, where, you know, things are, you know, aimed at specific groups and targeted at specific groups. And that what you see when you break out the country this way is those specific groups tend to live in specific areas. And, you know, it's increasingly, you know, as much as we talk about how the Internet is everywhere and isn't it wonderful, like, you know, if you really like to read the New York Times and you're in the middle of Oklahoma and you've got a high-speed Internet connection, you can just read the New York Times no matter where you are. It's like, well, that is true, and that's wonderful if you like reading the New York Times. But you know, most people who live there don't do that. That's what everybody has to keep in mind. So even though the idea is the Internet is available everywhere and, oh, look, we all have access to the same thing, that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at the Internet, it is a, you know, a million-channel cable network or a million-channel cable service, and people are going to gravitate to specific channels to get information and entertainment. You know, and there are different things that matter. Look, if you live in a farming community, there are things that matter to you that don't matter to somebody that lives in kind of in a suburban community. And even though you have access to, you know, even though you have access to all these things, all these same news outlets as everybody else, you're going to go to the things that most affect you. And in terms of the political views of those places, they tend to be different, you know. So the cultures of these specific kinds of place, you know, actually, you know, lead to there being less of a uniform kind of American experience. As much as we think of the Internet as this great leveler and it makes everything equal and even, it really doesn't. I mean, everybody has access to everything equally, but where they choose to go is increasingly varied. So the country, you know, even as we're all sharing the same Internet, the Internet's a vast thing. And people are more and more able to kind of wander off into their particular niche and live there.
Right. Let's look at the recession for a moment and how it's affected, because I know you've done a lot of written work about this before the book came out.
Right.
But I'm interested in those places. You concentrate on Eagle and as a boom town, and there are 405 counties, you say, are boom towns with 61 million people, pretty wealthy locales, people who have done well in the last 10 years or 20 years, and they've built these huge houses, et cetera. How are they being hit?
They've really been hammered. I mean, they've been hammered particularly hard in the last in the housing crunch, because a way to think of the boom towns is a couple of things. I mean, there's a lot of new wealth there, like you say. These are people who have done well in the last 10 years or so, and you know, they moved maybe out of the established suburban communities to go to these boom towns, which tend to be a little more ex-urban in nature, a little more fringy, a little kind of on the edge of development. And they move out to those areas, and they bought these big houses, and, you know, things were going great guns, and they spent a lot of money, and their house was worth a lot of money. And then, lo and behold, the housing crunch hit. Well, you know, when it hit, where did it hit? It hit those places on the fringe, and it hit the places where housing had boomed. Eagle, Colorado, you know, Eagle's a beautiful place. I love Eagle, Colorado, and I love going there, and I was just there again this summer talking to people. No, it's a completely different place. I mean, you know, talking about people losing on their homes $200,000 worth of value.
Ooh.
You know, and what happens when that happens? Well, a couple of things. Either that means that those people are not moving anywhere for a very long time, or they're going to take a big hit, or they can't, or the other thing that happens is when you had these boomtown communities, the really interesting thing was they got rich. A lot of them got rich on construction. You know, a really prominent boomtown you might think about would be Clark County in Nevada, which is where Las Vegas is. No, and Vegas made a lot of money just on building. Just they kept building and building and building, and they built more and more of these places. And as you build like that, people get wealthy. Builders get wealthy. People who do HVAC get wealthy. Carpenters get wealthy. And they're wealthy, and they think the good times in some ways aren't going to end, or they just need a place to live, and they're flush, and they spend money on a nice big place. And that's going to be, you know, the place they're going to live for 20 years. And then the housing crunch hits, and the construction stops, and all of a sudden the checks aren't coming in anymore. And they've got a big mortgage to pay off.
Right.
And, you know, so they have to find a way to pay that mortgage off, or they've got to sell the house. Well, the problem with trying to sell the house, which I'm sure a lot of people in Eagle, this has been a real problem. The problem with trying to sell the house is it's worth so much less now, they can't sell the house.
Mm-hmm.
They have to get short sales. I mean, so what you see in these boomtown places is the housing crunch really up close, and like you see the dominoes fall. It's like construction slows, and that hits incomes, and then the incomes fall. Once the incomes fall, you know, the houses, you know, that people have less money. So you have entire communities where everybody has less money. The values of every place falls, you know, and they're really kind of hanging on right now. I see, you know, those places are going to have a very tough road ahead, I think, for the next, you know, for the next decade or so, because construction is not going to come back anytime soon.
As you end that chapter, the road back to the good life is long indeed.
Yes.
Yeah. Dante Chinney is our guest this hour. His book, Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. We have just touched on boom towns and industrial metropolises and also campus and career areas, but there are many others, 12 others, and we're looking at, well, we will look more at how those counties tend to vote, which ones may be persuaded to go for one party or the other, how many, and part of that is because the midterms are rapidly approaching. We want to look at that. How many Walmarts there are and Starbucks, and why those figures are important when you look at these counties. What does it mean to have a Starbucks or more Starbucks than Walmarts or vice versa? Join our conversation and tell us about where you live. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow, we just booked a show on North Korea, so we're going to be talking about the change of power in that very, very bizarre, probably the most bizarre country on Earth. That will be tomorrow at 9. And we now are 39 pledges away from taking off a day of our pledge drive. So let's move that ahead and get rid of the first day of the pledge drive, okay? Go to WPR.org and you can make that happen. We welcome your phone calls for Dante, and we'll take them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to remind you that we are going to be doing a broadcast from the beautiful Milwaukee Art Museum, and it's going to take place on October 21st. It's with Nancy Pearl, author of the Booklust series, our favorite librarian who can recommend and remember every book she's ever read, and she's read more books than anybody you know. And Laurie Winters, who's the director of exhibitions at the museum, will be our guest. It is in the Calatrava. If you're listening to us from some part of the state and you haven't been to the art museum, it really is absolutely beautiful. It's a work of art. You just, all you have to do is go to the museum. Even if you don't want to see the paintings or the sculptures, you just go stand in the museum. And it's worth your day. So we're going to broadcast from there, and we will have some snacks and coffee after the broadcast, and we'll be talking books and looking at the lake and having a wonderful time with two great people. So please join us. If you could let Rhonda know that you're coming, or you can go to our Facebook page and say, yes, we would like to come so we can order enough food. Rhonda's is Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G. At WPR.org, and our Facebook is The Kathleen Dent Show. Okay? We hope to see you there. We should have a rip-roaring fine day. Dante Chinney is our guest, our Patchwork Nation, the surprising truth about the real America, the 12 community types that make up our nation, is his new book. And we start our calls with Rich from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Hi.
That was fast. Good morning.
Good morning.
Your author probably knows that Wisconsin is called America's Dairyland, and that's in name at the moment because we have rivals like California. And I like to call Wisconsin the heart of America's heartland, smack dab in the middle. But as I told you, screener, one of my worries is we do a terrific job post-secondary of educating people. But we have a kind of brain drain that goes on in Wisconsin. That is, we educate people, and it tends not to be a very youthful state. Our young people tend to go some to the surrounding states of Minnesota, Illinois, and when Michigan was prosperous, to Michigan. I'm wondering, I live in two counties, Jefferson in southern Wisconsin, which is classified by your author as an emptying nest county, and I'm now in Oneida County, where Rhinelander is, which is classified as a service worker center,
right?
Hotels, motels, so on and so forth. My concern is what your author can project as the, I guess I'd call it the prosperity arc for a region like Wisconsin, because we seem to be on a downward trend. Traditionally, when we were a highly unionized state and industrialized, our incomes were very competitive with the surrounding region. They're now less so. The average income in Wisconsin has dropped over the last 30 years compared to the surrounding states. And I'm wondering what he can say about the potential of Wisconsin, the heart of America's heartland, to be prosperous again.
That's a really good question. I mean, I live in the District of Columbia now, and I can tell you that on any given Saturday during the fall, you would need a calculator to keep track of all the Big Ten sweatshirts you see up and down the street as people, and not just kids. I mean, people in their 30s and 40s. Probably displaying their university colors, and not just Bucky Badger, but we see fair share of Wolverines and Spartans and other paraphernalia. There definitely, I would say, in a lot of the states in the Midwest, and particularly in Big Ten country, there, I think there is a real brain drain. It's a very serious problem, and I see it a lot in Michigan. The two counties you live in, the emptying nest down there, I think Jefferson, you said, and then up in Oneida, those places in particular tend to be a little older. You know, the challenge for all the Midwest, where there was manufacturing, the good thing about those manufacturing jobs is they paid well and they had good benefits. And even if you didn't go to college, your kids could go to college because you made money that made that possible. You know, increasingly that's less and less true. So what are they going to do? Well, I don't know. I think the first thing that has to happen is it is really possible that, and I know they think this in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and in Washington, and my guess is they probably think the same thing in Dane and in Madison County, too, that those places have to start becoming the drivers for the state. they have to become the economic drivers for the state because they have their the research money is going to flow in there. You've got to find a way to keep those brains. You have a lot of good. You get a lot of graduates from D.C. public schools actually even going. The good D.C. public schools going to Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin is, you know, University of Wisconsin has a great reputation. And you got to find a way to keep those brains. You got to find a way to keep them there. That's not going to be easy because, you know, the draw has always been in the Midwest, even in Michigan, is, you know, is go to Chicago or you go out to New York or you go to Washington or you go someplace else. How do you keep them there? You're going to have to build. I think that the universities are going to have to play a bigger role, and then I think what you're going to have to do is try to have more really public-private partnerships and have those universities become incubators for business. And they're already doing that, but they're going to need to do more of it. Even when you do that, though, there is a legitimate question about what you do for the rest of the population that doesn't have a college degree. I don't know what happens there. I think, and that's not just a problem for, you see it maybe prominently in the Midwest, but it's going to be a problem everywhere. And it is really what the next, I think, 10 years or 15 years for this country is going to be about. It's going to be about where we have long transitioned from manufacturing. What's next? We have to figure that out as a country. We're not there yet. We have a lot of work to do.
When we talk about the recession, and I know you've done some work with this, and was it in Oregon or Washington particularly? When we talked to you about a piece that you wrote, the service worker areas Rich was talking about, tourist centers, mid-sized towns, people live without employee benefits and on the margins.
Absolutely.
And many of them must be really on the margins right now.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's Oregon. It's Lincoln City, Oregon, where I go. Mm-hmm. And it is it's tough out there because those jobs don't offer benefits. And, the other thing is they don't offer benefits, and they used to be able to go to the health clinics in town. But the states have had such dramatic, you know, they're seeing budget cutbacks. How long can that go on? I don't know. But but people, you know, there are businesses in Lincoln City that are closing that had been open for decades upon decades, and they're closing now. Businesses like, you know, well-established restaurants and bars, it's not that those things paid great, but they paid money.
Right.
And they're going away now. And those places in Oneida County, up in northern Wisconsin, those places, I mean, we talk about it in the book, they rely on the kindness of strangers. You know, people have to come to town and spend money. That's how you get fresh money in there to flow around. How quickly is that going to start happening again if the consumer economy stays where it is right now? And there really isn't any sign that it's going to bounce back anytime soon. I don't know. It's going to be those places, those service worker centers are going to have and the empty nest, but I think particularly the service worker centers, because they tend to be a little more far-flung, they're really going to have a tough decade. And I do think that politically, that may be a reason why in some of those places we begin to see a shift one way or the other as people start, you know, clamoring for something to be legitimately different.
Meaning what? Politically?
You can start to see when you look at some of those places the beginnings, or at least the foundation for the beginnings of a true populist movement that would look very different, I think, from the Tea Party movement, which is, I don't really consider the Tea Party movement a populist movement. I don't imagine anybody in the Tea Party movement would give a William James Bryan, you know, cross of gold speech. That's a little different. But I mean, a true, legitimate populist movement that is anger at all elites, not just government, but anger, you know, and people who are angry about what's going on and wouldn't be advocating for, you know, keeping the tax cuts for people who make over $250,000 a year. I mean, people who really want to see people who have more money kick in more. And if things struggle like this for a while, I think you will see over time the rise of a legitimate populist movement from some of these places, and it's going to be just, we're going to have a really fascinating 10 years to watch here.
We were talking about this some yesterday. It seemed to me that would be a winning strategy for the Democrats, but they don't seem to be able to carry it off.
Well, and the Democrats are in a bit of a, you know, politically, they do very well with these places we call the moneyed burbs. And more people live there than any place else in the country. There's 69 million people that live there, and Obama won them by 11 points in 2008, after Kerry had won them by barely a percentage point in 2004. So, and what do those places have? Well, they've got a lot of people that are invested in the stock market. You know, not everybody there is rich. You know, it's rich is a relative term in America, but they have more people that do well there, more people making over $150,000 a year. So the Democratic Party right now is kind of an odd amalgamation of kind of educated wealthy people who think the party is pro business enough that they can do that and they can keep their jobs, and they like maybe some of their stances on environmental issues and social issues. And then people who are kind of, the other part of the Democratic Party is people who are on the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and who are struggling to make ends meet. And those two constituencies don't necessarily have a whole lot in common. And that's going to be a challenge. You've been able to hold it together because if there's enough prosperity, you can bring along the people who maybe don't make as much money, and the people on the top are fine. But as things dry up, especially for those people on the bottom, politically, that becomes a real challenge.
Thanks, Rich, always, for your call. Paul in Duluth. Hi.
Hi, to both of you. I hope I'm not getting too far off the mark here. I remember, I guess it was about a year, maybe a little longer ago, there was a writer who came out with the idea. He showed regionalization of America, mm-hmm. Overall, it was kind of more on a macro scale, and he had divided the country up into, I think it was five or six different.
Yep. Is it Joel Garrow and the Nine Nations of North America, right?
Oh, very okay. Good, Dante.
Yeah, okay, I'm glad you remembered it, because it made a splash, and then, other news events kind of, wiped it away. I'd like to hear your comment on that, but I'd also, as a former resident of Colorado, and somebody who worked for HBC Corporation,
mm-hmm.
Maybe you know that, they were planning on a major ski resort called
yeah.
Adams Rib in the Eagle
yeah.
Valley.
Yeah, yep.
And I'm wondering, all the development that went on there. I have driven that. Eagle used to be like a bedroom community for
Vail. Exactly.
Vail.
Yeah.
Dante.
Adams Rib, we actually go there in the book. Adams Rib became Adams Rib Ranch. That was a developer who forever was trying to get a ski resort put in there on the other side of Vail. He didn't get it, but he got a golf course. And it is extremely, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful setting. Eagle's just gorgeous. You're in the Rockies.
Costs a lot of money, that golf game, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. And as of the time we did the book, it's gone up a little bit since then. But I think the number of members at that golf club was 9.
Oh, my gosh.
There were literally 9 people because they built it with the idea that, the boom times are coming here and things are going to be great. And it just, everything collapsed at the wrong moment. They hadn't sold a single lot. And the only houses they had on the place were spec houses because they were houses built on the golf course, and they had 9 members. So that's Adams Rib is just having a heck of a time. And, he's got a lot of money. He can wait it out. But I just don't know when the economy that allowed for that to happen is going to come back. And Eagle, which used to be kind of a bedroom community of Vail, became its own little city, built largely on construction, and then the construction dried up, and they're having a hard time. The Nine Nations of North America, which I assume is what you're talking about, was a book by Joel Garrow a while back, and it is a very good book, but it's different from what we did in that it really was just kind of a reporter going in and looking at these different nations in the United States, and they're very broadly drawn. And one thing he actually had a category of the country in there, a region of the country called the Foundry. And the Foundry took in, eastern Pennsylvania and almost all of Michigan, all of the lower peninsula of Michigan anyway. And I can just tell you, there's maybe for that, and I like the book, I'm not criticizing the book, but it's what we did is a different kind of analysis. And the things he placed in the Foundry don't really fit. I mean, the Foundry included, kind of suburban Philly and Pittsburgh, but it also had, Penn State's campus, Michigan's campus, Detroit, and then you'd go up and you'd catch kind of the northern part of the lower peninsula of Michigan, which is, there's nothing industrial about that area. I mean, that's where they make cherries, that's what comes from there.
So I like the Nine Nations, and definitely we're kind of following along on what Mr. Garrett did. But we really think that this level of analysis, when you get down to county, things, and that's something we're just talking about this morning, about talking about the difference between Dane County and Milwaukee County. It's just going county to county, you can see real differences in the country.
Right.
We kind of think of this as a 12 kind of discontiguous states of the United States of America. There, it's could have a service worker center in Michigan, and it's a lot like a service worker center on the coast of Oregon. We make a point in the book.
Thanks, Paul, for the call. Before we go to our next call, can you tell me why Walmart and Starbucks stores, what they say about counties?
All this consumer data, where stores are placed, I mean, I think people will find that fun just because it's interesting.
Yeah, it is fun.
Yeah, it is fun, but there's more to it than that. It's, Walmart is not some little mom-and-pop thing, and they just kind of open stores willy-nilly by throwing darts at a map. They go through a bunch of demographic data and research about places, and they place things where they think they will do well. And the fact of the matter is, places that have a lot of Walmarts in them are different than places that have a lot of Starbucks. And Starbucks is the same thing. Starbucks is, or Whole Foods, it's the same thing. They're very specific about where they're placing stores. So if you look at Starbucks locations per, 100,000 people in the country, or by county, the moneyed burbs by far have the most. It's 7.5 Starbucks for every 100,000 people. That's a lot of lattes. And if you break it down the other way and you look at where the most Walmarts, the most Walmarts per 100,000 people are in the evangelical epicenters, the Christian kind of socially conservative places of America. And then there's, everything, there's a lot of stuff in between there. But those things say something about those communities. They say something about the demographics of the people who live there, what the money they have to spend, where they're looking to shop, where they want to shop. And, where they want to shop, shopping is increasingly, because of the demographic splits in America, something of a, whether you like it or not, a semi-political or cultural act. You're saying something by shopping at Walmart, and you're saying something
sure.
when you buy that latte at Starbucks.
Exactly, or refusing to shop at Walmart,
absolutely.
Which is saying something as well.
Which is definitely the case in a lot of
places. Right. Isn't it amazing how much money we spend on coffee?
I just took a sip of my Starbucks, as you said.
Oh,
and
did you?
I don't like how much money I've spent on coffee, but it's the closest thing, and the coffee in the office is lousy.
Yeah, you know what? I brought mine from home. I do it every other day now so I can...
Save some money.
Save a little bit of money.
It's wise. Yeah. It's wise.
Yeah. And then you can treat yourself. So one day it's Starbucks,
right.
One day it's Dante's Coffee.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Making an event.
Yeah. Stanley is next from Augusta. Hi, Stanley.
Hello. I've been listening to this with great interest, and then I brought it up, the map up on my computer, and I live in Eau Claire County, and it's labeled a boom town.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
I don't live in that
part of Eau Claire County. And I get to looking, and none of Wisconsin gets to be tractor country.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and yet half of Eau Claire County, I mean, maybe I don't understand the definition of tractor country, but half of Eau Claire County has nothing to do with the city of Eau Claire, Altoona.
Right.
That's over there, and we're over here.
And you have a county, I think it's Baton Rouge, featured in your book, that part of the county is one thing and part is another.
Yeah, and this is the, this is the one thing about using counties. And people will tell you that counties are not specific enough. Demographers love counties because they're a nice level of breakdown. But counties are still big. And ultimately, Eau Claire is what it is because enough population lives around Eau Claire that it dictates what the place is. So, that's even true when you look at Washtenaw County, where Ann Arbor is. When you get to the far reaches of Washtenaw County, it's fairly rural. But the population center, where the people actually live, and the income for the county, all comes from the greater Ann Arbor area. And I think, the thing with Eau Claire is, the reason it was placed as the reason it was made a boom town was the fact that it grew rapidly over the last 10 years, and the problem when you get to some of these counties that are big is like you don't feel that where you are if you're on the other side of the county, but in terms of what's happened to the county, it's what's happened overall when you look at the population. And I would add too that it's true that it doesn't affect you completely directly, but you do share a government with them, and there are tax issues, there are revenue issues that are about the county, and there are foreclosure issues and things like that that arise out of that as well.
counties aren't perfect. They are the best thing. To go below counties, you'd have to go down to the zip code or census tract level. Zip codes would take you, I think there's something like 44 or 50-some-odd thousand of them.
Whoa!
We actually considered doing it. We did consider doing it, but in terms of mapping, it just would have been completely impossible. And we feel counties aren't perfect, but we feel, and we bring this up in the book, that we think they offer enough difference between places to let you have a real peek at.
Yeah. I wonder how many of these are southern, but I found these minority central regions to be interesting, where you have different worlds living side by side. You know, one side of the street is white and one side of the street is black, and you can wave to each other now, but don't come on my lawn.
Yeah, I mean, and Baton Rouge was really interesting. It's where I went for that. And Baton Rouge is it's really black and white in every possible way. It's Baton Rouge is whites live in one part of the town and blacks live in another part of the town. And, you know, they have clubs that, you know, blacks go to one kind of bar and whites go to another kind of bar. And, like, you'll go to one and you'll go to one and you won't see a black person. You go to another one and you won't see a white person. And they even have different universities. It's because LSU is on one side of town and Southern is on the other. Now, obviously, you know LSU is integrated. But there definitely is a feeling that, like, and, you know, Southern is on the poor black end of town, LSU is on the rich white end of town, and they get treated differently. You know, that said, people, it is, like you say, it's not that there's overt hostility between people there. I mean, there's some, probably, but it's just really more of just a way of life. You live over there, I live over here, and you don't bother me, and I won't bother you, and let's just leave it at that.
Dante Chinney is our guest. His book, Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email, if you want to use that today, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, if we could just talk about a couple more of the counties. It's interesting, I think people will find that you have a whole category of Mormon outposts. Why?
That was an interesting category, and we added them later on, and there's a reason for that. When we originally did this, there were only 11 category types and county categories, and we'd place these places that are Mormon communities into this community type we have called the Evangelical Epicenters, most of them anyway. We later went back and changed that, and we did it because when you really look at those places, their cultures are just very different. The Mormon outposts are truly a unique kind of place in America, and a lot of it's because you look where they're based. They're obviously mostly based in the Mountain West around Utah. They were founded by the Mormon Church sending out settlers to go populate a county. And that has, so they are very uniform in the way that a lot of times the county, and the one I look at, the county commission is still all controlled by Mormons. The city council is all Mormon, you know, and it creates kind of a very kind of harmonious atmosphere where everybody's really on the same page. Worth noting, actually, is when you look at the types here, Salt Lake City is not a Mormon outpost anymore. It's seen so much growth that it is a boomtown. It really is. It is not majority Mormon anymore, and obviously, you know, that the attitudes toward drinking there and everything have changed. The outposts are probably the single most different kind of community in the country because they're very religious, obviously. But the other thing you see is in the evangelical epicenters, a lot of times you have a lot of different Protestant congregations kind of I don't want to say fighting, but they have different ideas about, you know, different congregations means different people and different kind of centers of power. In those Mormon outposts, it's one church really kind of running the show.
Doug is our next caller from Western Michigan. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you today? Thanks for a great topic. And Dante, it's interesting about your analysis. I live in actually a little town called Zeeland, Michigan, which is next to Holland, and we are seeing a resurgence of certain energy industries like the battery industry and that type of thing. There's a big Korean outfit that's going to be building batteries. I think it's LQ Industries or something. I can't remember. But then there's also some wind energy takeoffs as a result of our boat building efforts in western Michigan. I wondered if that signaled something new as far as a return to industrial production of some kind and what that might spell long term. Also, we are seeing the brain drain over there. I mean,
yeah.
if I was a 20-something and I was looking at Zeeland or Holland or even Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'd have to think twice about whether I wanted to stay there if I'm an educated person with a degree and whether I might find the kind of work that would make me prosper. So I see that, and I'm concerned about that because I'm in my 50s.
Yeah, I grew up in Michigan. I actually interned at the Grand Rapids Press, and I spent a month at the Holland Bureau of the Grand Rapids Press.
Oh.
Yeah, so I know of what you speak. I think that there will be some return to manufacturing. I do think manufacturing will come back a bit. It just will never be what it is for a couple of reasons. I think that there are just places to manufacture things that are cheaper, like China. And that's, it's just generally going to be cheaper to do things there. That's the other, that's first part of it. The other part is mechanization. I mean, I took my son, we went home to, took my family, my son loved it, to the River Rouge plant outside Detroit, where Ford built, a mile-long construction area. And they don't have as many people on the line anymore, and there will be fewer and fewer of them. And that's just, and they say that themselves, that's just the nature of the beast. That's what's going to happen in manufacturing. I don't know what you do about the brain drain. Like I say, I think that I think you have to, because so much of what's going to happen in the next decade is going to be driven by strong education. I just think people have to try to, the states and the communities have to try to build things around education. And actually, I do really quickly. I do know that in Kent County, I've been reading around Grand Rapids that they've been trying to reach out and work more with Michigan State, and I think they're working with their medical school now. I think those things are the smart things to do in the long run.
Thanks, Doug. Carol in Muscadet. Hi.
Hi. Two questions. I hope they're fast. First of all, how does your book overlap with The Big Sort, which mm-hmm. came out a couple of years ago, about the more and more concentrated clustering of like groups and across the country? And I think it tries to pick up on the culture of place as well, in the
Absolutely.
Same ways that you are. And then my second question is, literature has, fiction has sometimes, often actually tried to capture culture of place in ways that sociologists haven't but are beginning to, and that's all interesting. And if you know, I just finished reading the book Driftless, so by David Rhodes, which is about the area I live in, the Driftless area, and where I live immediately, I must drive, for instance, 15 miles to get a good cup of coffee.
Right.
But I can buy beer blocks away, any time of the day. So that sort of sums it up for me in terms of culture of place in many respects. But I know there's more depth than that going on here, and that's where authors like David Rhodes is very helpful.
Yeah, first thing I'd say is The Big Sort. I love The Big Sort. I'm Bill Bishop and I are email buddies. We chat all the time. He's the guy who wrote that book. Terrific. Bill's book is really much more about people deciding to live with like-minded people and deliberately doing so, which I think actually plays into a lot of what we're seeing. We're not really looking at why the country breaks down this way. We're just saying this is the way the country breaks down. And I think that that Bill's findings about people wanting to live with more like-minded people means that what we're seeing in Patchwork Nation is actually, especially what we talked about with how uniqueness of American experience is going to fall away even more, because people will choose to live by other people who live like them, and their experiences will be different than the people who live on the other county who choose different experiences. As for fiction writing, I love fiction writing about place. I love places. I really do. What we're trying to do, and we try to do in the book, is we try to tell stories. At least in the first 12 chapters where we're talking about these places, it's not literature. I'm not that good a writer, I don't think. But I'm just a dumb journalist. But we're really telling the stories.
You're not dumb.
We're telling the stories of these places. And we're trying to do some of that. And, I think maybe I'll write a 12
part fiction series about these towns, which would be great fun for me anyway.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting what you write about all of those places. It reads beautifully. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah, think a little better yourself, Dante. Come on. Yeah,
I'm playing dumb.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the air, Dante.
No, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Dante Chinney, the book is Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. And Dante is... been visiting these places for the past couple of years. He goes to each of them frequently, and they're all interesting. And it tells a lot about the future of the country and how the recession is affecting various counties and what we have in common, be we thousands of miles apart, if we live in one of those 12 counties. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, we will be talking about North Korea, and we hope you'll listen. If you want to pledge, we're now 39 pledges away, 38, WPR.org.